The guru of football, is it not? Actually, when we programmed this, we really didn't know if this was going to take place, but we should have looked at the schedule. When Saturday comes, it would all work out fine. However, we've got a cunning plan. Okay, tonight is indeed the match of matches, which is the European Cup final. And let's all pray for Bayern Munich. But the cunning plan is this. Hopefully just after Nick is read, before questions and answers, or just after that, somebody will come into the back and give me the result so far, which I shall then flash up from the back there so that it can be announced from the front. The game is being screened live in the Students' Union, for those of you who are desperate to go. But don't be too desperate to go, because after the questions and answers, there will be a signing. Books are for sale, and they're here at the back. Those of you who have got your mobile radios tuned to 5 Live, please turn them off. Well, I have the pleasure of welcoming Russell Kellen-Jones, will be chairing, and Nick Hornby.
It's nice to see so many non-Manchester United supporters here tonight. Welcome. When I first met Nick Hornby 10 years ago, we actually introduced each other to each other, and it was in a party for a newspaper we both worked at the time. So it's kind of my pleasure, really, to be able to introduce him, in a sense, properly. And in a sense, of course, he doesn't really need a great deal of introduction, so I'm not going to make this an elaborate beginning. But he's the author of 3 books, Fever Pitch, a football memoir, and 2 novels, High Fidelity and About a Boy. He sold probably in far in excess of 1 million copies of his books around the world. Fever Pitch itself was made into a play and a film, and High Fidelity is actually in production now in America, and the film rights to About a Boy have been bought by Robert De Niro. I think he's got many, many imitators who are all seeking the holy grail of critical and commercial success that Nick has had. But I know for a fact that he never manufactured the success by strategically setting out to write a bestseller. Fever Pitch, his first book, actually sold by word of mouth initially. And it seemed to me that there was something he was saying that hadn't been said before about many things, but specifically about masculinity, I think. And I think before Nick Hornby arrived, male vulnerability was seen somewhat of an oxymoron. He's shown that men have an inner life, and his work is hugely entertaining, and he deserves the readership that he's acquired now. So it gives me great pleasure to introduce Nick.
Hi. I'm sure you're all aware of this, but the true footballing significance of the evening is nothing whatsoever to do with Manchester United. It's the 10th anniversary since Arsenal won the league at Anfield in 1989. So I think we should all spare a thought for Michael Thomas at some point in the evening. About 5 to 10, I think, is the time. I'm going to read... first of all, a small piece from High Fidelity, and then a chapter from About a Boy. High Fidelity, for those of you who haven't read it, it's an unlikely, I think, American film, in that it's the story of a guy who works in a record shop and splits up with his girlfriend, and at the end he makes her a tape. That's the climax. So they can make of that what they will, but I wouldn't watch it. I'm going to read from the beginning of the book. What's happened so far is, well, the guy split up with his girlfriend and has been to work in his record shop. And that's all in chapter one. So I was worried about what it would be like coming back to the flat tonight, but it's fine. The unreliable sense of well-being I've had since this morning is still with me. And anyway, it won't always be like this with all her things around. She'll clear it out soon, and the Marie Celestial air about the place, the half-read Julian Barnes paperback on the bedside table and the knickers in the dirty clothes basket will vanish. Women's knickers were a terrible disappointment to me when I embarked on my cohabiting career. I never really recovered from the shock of discovering that women do what we do. They save their best pairs for the nights when they know they're going to sleep with somebody. When you live with a woman, these faded, shrunken, tatty M&S scraps suddenly appear on radiators all over the house. Your lascivious schoolboy dreams of adulthood as a time when you're surrounded by exotic lingerie forever and ever, amen. Those dreams crumble to dust. I clear away the evidence of last night's traumas, the spare duvet on the sofa, the balled-up paper hankies, the coffee mugs with dog ends floating in the cold, oily-looking dregs, and then I put the Beatles on. And when I've listened to Abbey Road in the first few tracks of Revolver, I open the bottle of white wine that Laura brought home last week, sit down and watch the Brookside omnibus that I taped. In the same way that nuns end up having their periods at the same time, Laura's mum and my mum have mysteriously ended up synchronising their weekly phone calls. Mine rings first. Hello, love, it's me. Oh, hi. Everything all right? Not bad. What sort of a week have you had? Oh, you know. How's the shop doing? So-so, up and down. Up and down would be great. Up and down would imply that some days are better than others, that customers came and went. This has not been the case, frankly. Your dad and I are very worried about this recession. Yeah, you said. You're lucky Laura's doing so well. If it wasn't for her, I don't think either of us would ever get off to sleep. She's gone, Mum. She's thrown me to the wolves. The bitch has fucked off and left me. No, can't do it. This does not seem to be the right time for bad news. Heaven knows she's got enough on her plate without having to worry about a shop full of blooming old pop records. How can one describe the way people born before 1940 say the word pop? I've been listening to my parents' sneering one-syllable explosion for well over two decades. I'm surprised she doesn't make you sell up and get a proper job. It's a wonder she's hung on as long as she has. I would have left you to get on with it years ago. Hold on, Rob. Don't let her get to you. Don't rise to the bait. Don't... Oh, fuck it. Well, she has left me to get on with it now, so that should cheer you up. Where's she gone? I don't bloody know. Just gone. Moved out. Disappeared. There is a long, long silence. The silence is so long, in fact, that I can watch the whole of a row between Jimmy and Jackie Corkkill without hearing so much as a long-suffering sigh down the receiver. Hello, anybody there? And now I can hear something. The sound of my mother crying softly. What is it with mothers? What's happening here? As an adult, you know that as life goes on, you're going to spend more and more time looking after the person who started out looking after you. That's par for the course. But my mum and I swapped roles when I was about 9. Anything bad that has happened to me in the last couple of decades, detentions, bad exam marks, getting thumped, getting bunged from college, splitting up with girlfriends, has ended up like this, with mum visibly or audibly upset. It would have been better for both of us if I'd moved to Australia when I was 15, phoned home once a week, and reported a sequence of fictitious major triumphs. Most 15-year-olds would find it tough living on their own on the other side of the world with no money and no friends and no family and no job and no qualifications, but not me. It would have been a piece of piss compared to listening to this stuff week after week. It's not fair. It's not fair. Since I left home, all she's done is moan, worry, and send cuttings from the local newspaper describing the minor successes of old school friends. Is that good parenting? Not in my book. I want sympathy, understanding, advice, and money, and not necessarily in that order. But these are alien concepts in Canning Close. I'm all right if that's what's upsetting you. I know that's not what's upsetting her. You know that's not what's upsetting me. Well, it bloody well should be, shouldn't it? Shouldn't it? Mum, I've just been dumped. I'm not feeling so good. And not so bad either. The Beatles, half a bottle of Chardonnay and Brookside have all done their stuff. But I'm not telling her that. I can't deal with me, let alone you. I knew this would happen. Well, if you knew it would happen, what are you so cut up about? What are you going to do, Rob? I'm going to drink the rest of a bottle of wine in front of the box, then I'm going to bed, then I'll get up and go to work. And after that, meet a nice girl and have children. This is the right answer. Well, if only it was that easy. It is, I promise. Next time I speak to you, I'll have it sorted. She's almost smiling. I can hear it. I'm beginning to see some light at the end of the long, dark telephonic tunnel. But what did Laura say? Do you know why she's gone? Not really. Well, I do. This is momentarily alarming until I understand what she's on about. Oh, it's nothing to do with marriage, Mum, if that's what you mean. Well, so you say. I'd like to hear her side of it. Cool it. Don't let it... That. Fuck it. Mum, how many more times, for Christ's sake? Laura didn't want to get married. She's not that sort of girl, to coin a phrase. That's not what happens now. I don't know what does happen now, apart from you meet someone and you move in together and she goes, and you meet someone and you move in together and she goes. Fair point, I guess. Shut up, Mum. That's Rob Fleming. In About a Boy, there are two central characters. One's a guy called Will Freeman, who is 36 years old, doesn't do anything, doesn't want to do anything, lives off the royalties of a song that his father wrote, doesn't want a relationship, has sex but doesn't have relationships, and is certainly not interested in children, but has recently had the experience of a relationship with a single mother, which he thought was pretty good, in that when they split, he felt completely blameless. She felt the situation was too difficult to continue. And he also felt that because she was very beautiful, it had to be something to do with her status. So he's decided that single mothers are the way forward for him. Unfortunately, he can't meet any. I'm a single father. I have a two-year-old boy. I'm a single father. I have a two-year-old boy. I'm a single father. I have a two-year-old boy. However many times Will told himself this, he could always find some reason that prevented him from believing it. In his own head, not the place that counted the most, but important nevertheless, he didn't feel like a parent. He was too young, too old, too stupid, too smart, too groovy, too impatient, too selfish, too careless, too careful. Whatever the contraceptive circumstances of the woman he was seeing, he always, always used a condom, even in the days before you had to. He didn't know enough about kids, he went out too often, he drank too much, he took too many drugs. When he looked in the mirror, he couldn't see a dad, especially a single dad. He was trying to see a single dad in the mirror because he'd run out of single mums to sleep with. In fact, Angie had so far proved to be both the beginning and the end of his supply. It was all very well deciding that single mums were the future, that there were millions of sad, Julie Christie-like waifs just dying for his call, but the frustrating truth was that he didn't have any of their phone numbers. Where did they hang out? It took him longer than it should have done to realise that, by definition, single mothers had children, and children, famously, prevented one from hanging out anywhere. He'd made a few gentle, half-hearted inquiries of friends and acquaintances, but had so far failed to make any real headway. The people he knew either didn't know any single mothers or were unwilling to effect the necessary introductions due to Will's legendarily poor romantic track record. But now he'd found the ideal solution to this unexpected dearth of prey. He'd invented a two-year-old son called Ned and had joined a single parents group. Most people wouldn't have bothered to go to these lengths to indulge a whim, but Will quite often bothered to do things that most people wouldn't bother to do simply because he had the time to bother. Doing nothing all day gave him endless opportunities to dream and scheme and pretend to be something he wasn't. He had, after a fit of remorse following a weekend of extreme self-indulgence, volunteered to work in a soup kitchen. And even though he never actually reported for duty, the phone call had allowed him to pretend for a couple of days that he was the kind of guy who might. And he'd thought about VSO and filled in the forms. And he'd cut out an advert in the local paper about teaching slow learners to read, and he'd contacted estate agents about opening a restaurant and then a bookshop. The point was that if you had a history of pretending, then joining a single parent group when you were not a single parent was neither problematic nor particularly scary. If it didn't work out, he'd just have to try something else. It was no big deal. SPAT. Single parents, alone, together. Met on the first Thursday of the month in a local adult education centre, and tonight was Will's first time. He was almost sure that tonight would be his last time, too. He'd get something wrong, like the name of Postman Pat's cat, or the colour of Noddy's car, or, more crucially, the name of his own child. For some reason, he couldn't stop thinking of him as Ted, and he'd only christened him Ned this morning, and he'd be exposed as a fraud and frog-marched off the premises. The car park at the centre contained just one other vehicle, a beaten-up B-Reg 2CV, which had, according to the stickers in its window, been to Chessington World of Adventure and Alton Towers. Will's car, the new GTI, hadn't been anywhere like that at all. Why not? He couldn't think of any reason why not, apart from the glaringly obvious one that he was a childless single man aged 36, and therefore had never had the desire to drive miles to plunge down a plastic fairy mountain on a tea tray. The centre depressed him. He hadn't set foot inside a place with classrooms and corridors and homemade posters for nearly 20 years, and he'd forgotten that British education smelt of disinfectant. It hadn't occurred to him that he wouldn't be able to find the spat party. He thought he'd be led straight to it by the happy buzz of people forgetting their troubles and getting roaring drunk, but there was no happy buzz, just the distant, mournful clank of a bucket. Finally, he spotted a piece of file paper pinned to a classroom door with the word SPAT! Exclamation mark scrawled on it in felt-tip pen. The exclamation mark put him off. It was trying too hard. There was only one woman in the room. She was taking bottles of white wine, beer, mineral water and supermarket brand cola out of a cardboard box and putting them onto a table in the centre of the room. The rest of the tables had been pushed to the back. The chairs were stacked in rows behind them. It was the most desolate party venue Will had ever seen. "Have I come to the right place?" he asked the woman. "Spat, come in. Are you Will? I'm Francis." He smiled and shook her hand. He'd spoken to Francis on the phone earlier in the day. "I'm sorry there's nobody else here yet, Will. We quite often get off to a slow start. Babysitters." "Oh, of course." So, he was wrong to be prompt. He'd more or less given himself away already. And, of course, he should never have said, "of course," which implied that she had clarified something he was finding puzzling. He should have rolled his eyes and said, "tell me about it," or, "don't talk to me about babysitters," something weary and conspiratorial. Maybe it wasn't too late. He rolled his eyes. "Don't talk to me about babysitters," he said. He laughed bitterly and shook his head, just for good measure. Francis ignored the eccentric conversational timing and took the cue. "Oh, did you have trouble tonight, then?" "No, my mother's looking after him." He was proud of the use of the pronoun. It implied familiarity. On the debit side, though, there had been an awful lot of head-shaking, eye-rolling and bitter laughter for a man with no apparent babysitting difficulties. "I've had trouble before, though," he added hastily. The conversation was less than 2 minutes old, and already he was a nervous wreck. "Haven't we all?" said Francis. Will laughed heartily. "Yes," he said, "I know I have." It was now perfectly clear he felt he was either a liar or a lunatic. But before he could dig himself any deeper into a hole which was already shipping water, other SPAT members, all of them women, all but one of them in their 30s, started to arrive. Francis introduced him to each of them. Sally and Moira, who looked tough, ignored him completely, helped themselves to a paper cupful of white wine and disappeared off to the furthest corner of the room. Moira, Will noted with interest, was wearing a Lorena Bobbitt T-shirt. Lizzie, who was small, sweet and scatty, Helen and Susanna, who obviously regarded SPAT as beneath their dignity and made rude comments about the wine and the location, Saskia, who was 10 years younger than anybody else in the room and looked more like somebody's daughter than somebody's mother, and Susie, who was tall, blonde, pale, nervy-looking and beautiful. She'd do, he thought, and stopped looking at anyone else who came in. Blonde and beautiful were two of the qualities he was looking for. Pale and nervy-looking were two of the qualities that gave him the right to do so. "Hello," he said, "I'm Will. I'm new and I don't know anybody." "Hello, Will. I'm Susie. I'm old and I know everybody." He laughed and she laughed, and he spent as much of the evening as courtesy allowed in her company. His conversation with Francis had sharpened him up, so he did better on the Ned front. In any case, Susie wanted to talk, and in these circumstances he was happy to listen. There was a lot to listen to. Susie had been married to a man called Dan, who'd started an affair when she was 6 months pregnant and had left her the day before she went into labour. Dan had only seen his daughter Megan once, accidentally, in the body shop in Islington. He hadn't seemed to want to see her again. Susie was now poor and bitter, and Will could understand why. She looked around the room. "One of the reasons I like coming here is that you can be angry and no one thinks any the less of you," she said. "Just about everyone's got something they're angry about." "Really?" They didn't look that angry to Will. "Well, let's see who's here. The woman in the denim shirt over there? Her husband went because he thought their little boy wasn't his." "Oh, Helen, boring. He went off with someone from work. Moira, he came out. Susanna Curtis, I think he was running two families." There were endless, ingenious variations on the same theme. men who took one look at their new child and went, men who took one look at their new colleague and went, men who went for the hell of it. Immediately, Will understood Moira's sanctification of Lorena Bobbitt completely. By the time Susie had finished her litany of treachery and deceit, he wanted to cut off his own penis with a kitchen knife. "Aren't there any other men who come to spat?" he asked Susie. "Just one, Jeremy. He's on holiday." "Oh, so women do leave sometimes. Jeremy's wife was killed in a car crash." Oh, well. Will was becoming so depressed about his sex that he decided to redress the balance. "So, I'm on my own," he said, in what he hoped was a mysteriously wistful tone. "I'm sorry," said Susie. "I haven't asked you anything about yourself." "Oh, doesn't matter. Did you get dumped then?" "Well, I suppose I did, yes." He gave her a sad, stoical smile. "And does your ex see Ned?" "Sometimes. She's not really that bothered." He was beginning to feel better. It was good to be the bearer of bad news about women. True, this bad news was entirely fictitious, but there was, he thought, an emotional truth here somewhere, and he could see now that his role-playing had a previously unsuspected artistic element to it. He was acting, yes, but in the noblest and most profound sense of the word. He wasn't a fraud, he was Robert De Niro. "How does he cope with that?" "Oh, he's a good little boy, very brave. They have amazing resources, kids, don't they?" To his astonishment, he found himself blinking back a tear, and Susie put a reassuring hand on his arm. "He was in here, no doubt about it. Thank you."
Thank you, Nick. You write about men, but you tend to read novels by women quite a lot. I think Laurie Moore is one of your favourite authors. Mm. Has reading women influenced the way you write internally about men?
Well, I think reading women kind of influenced everything, really, because the kinds of books that I wanted to write were, I guess, for want of a better term, domestic. And when I started High Fidelity in particular, I couldn't think of too many novels by men that had that thing of presenting the internal life, especially the internal romantic life of a male. So people like Anne Tyler and Laurie Moore, Alison Lurie, quite a few others, they were the models rather than anyone else I could think of my own sex.
Yeah, and you also write, you know, you mentioned that kind of domesticity that you prefer to write about, and the family, of course, is a domestic universal experience, like football, if you like. But the families in About a Boy are all pretty dysfunctional, and Will Freeman, of course, spends his whole adult life trying to avoid such complications until he gets involved with Marcus, the 12-year-old boy, and he suddenly finds himself involved in these families despite themselves. And I think what you do is in About a Boy, you kind of imply that life doesn't follow the bus route sometimes, and that seems to be a point, really, that you that those men who do try to miss out on all complications of life actually miss out on something quite important. Would you say that was right?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I did want to write about in About a Boy, I guess I know a few kids who do have incredibly complicated relationships with adults. In kind of a nice way, I thought there was something very heartening about it. That, you know, there are kids I know who see their dad's ex-girlfriend and their mum's ex-boyfriend and their mum's ex-boyfriend's mum. And this seemed to me something that was genuinely new. It wasn't something that was part of my experience as a child or the experience of anybody that I'd come across. So it's something that's happened, you know, I think particularly in the 80s and 90s. And this idea that even as the nuclear family is disintegrating, there is some kind of functioning replacement struck me as a kind of fruitful area to write about. Yeah. I think.
Now, there's a nice line, I can't remember whose son it is, but it might be Marcus's father who comes up to him, a sort of absent father, and his way of relating to his 12-year-old is to say, do you mind if I smoke a joint, you know, in the kitchen, first thing he says to him. But there's something about, I'll have to read this now, but on the first page, I think, of High Fidelity, Rob Fleming is talking about his childhood, and he says something which I think is quite fundamental to your work, and he says, unhappiness really meant something back then in childhood. Now it's just a drag. I think, you know, you prefer to write about unhappiness in a different kind of way, with a lightness of touch, but also as comedy.
Well, I think that if you want to write comedy, first of all, I think you have to find people who are screwed up. I mean, I keep being asked, you know, why do I write about these underachieving, feckless 35-year-old men? And you think, well, why would you want to write about an overachieving, happily married, bang on...
Well, that's
35-year-old men. There's nothing funny to say about them. Or if they're going to start that way, something has to happen to them along the way that makes them not like that. So that's the first thing. The other thing is that I don't like reading comic novels that don't have sadness in them. I think they can become very cartoonish. And a lot of the writers that I like, Laurie Moore and Anne Tyler in particular, that there's some bottom there. There are passages of uproarious comedy, but basically the characters are not very happy in those books.
Mm. There's something about your style that's always interested me, really, and it's the way it's deceptively simple. And I think it's about the language you use in your books seems to be the ordinary day-to-day conversational language that we all have in common, and yet you do something with it which is extraordinary. And I think it's a paradoxical thing. Maybe it's the way you invert the language. You take the language of television, let's say, and the language is somehow wrapped up with a utopian notion of the family, of manhood, and you get these dysfunctional characters to internalize this language. And I think, you know, I'm not sure how deliberate that is, but you seem to lead your readers into a very complex emotional kind of vortex through this very familiar language. Is that something that's quite deliberate?
Kind of thing. What was deliberate was wanting to write the kinds of books that I myself wanted to read. And I think partly it comes from an experience of teaching. And I wasn't a very committed teacher, but I was very committed to the idea of comprehensive education. Mm. And the idea of comprehensive education is that you can sit kids in a room, very bright kids and very slow kids, and you can find material that suits all of them. You know, something like Hemingway, where the intelligence is not connected with the vocabulary, but with the quality of observation. Mm. And you can see a slow 11-year-old coming to the same conclusions as an incredibly bright 15-year-old, and both of them are responding properly to the material. And I think that, for me, so much of what is wrong with literature, particularly British literature, particularly contemporary British literature, is that it's given up on that. It's it's not easy to read. It is overcomplicated, and when you look at where the complexity comes from, it comes from the language, it doesn't come from the ideas. You can read a whole 600-page, almost indigestible novel, and you'll come to the conclusion that it was about how the media controls our lives, or whatever. And you think, Jesus, you know, 3 months it took me to read that, and and that's what he's saying. And it drives me nuts, and I think the longer I've gone on, the more I've come to the conclusion that what we understand as literature and literary fiction is, for the most part, people who couldn't be bothered to do another 3 drafts. I know that sounds awful, but James Joyce is one thing, but there are other people who are not James Joyce, whose work is not actually much easier to read than that.
Yeah. No, they seem to be kind of trying to hurt you, I think.
Yes,
You know, they might as well come along and bash you over the head with a book. I mean, I'm not going to talk too much to you about football because, you know, it's my Achilles heel, really. I don't know a huge amount about that field, but...
Russell said he was supporting Manchester United because there was a Welsh player playing for Manchester United.
Yeah, Ryan Giggs, right?
Ryan Giggs.
Yeah,
exactly. So I've told him that there are three Welshmen playing for Bayern Munich, and he's he's now switched allegiances,
yeah,
so don't tell him.
I said, really? And also when, you know, Marcus says, you know, Kurt Cobain, he plays for Manchester United, doesn't he? I thought, well, yeah, he does. But, you know, having said that, you know, I often think of, I mean, I also live near the Arsenal ground, not as close as Nick, who lives in it. but it's a kind of, a football stadium seems to be a place where people gain identity, and particularly in your books, they do. And it's also a sort of church, it's a sort of Saturday church. But it's also a place where, you know, you're not just there with 60,000 other people and the priests, the high priests playing on the pitch. But it's a historical moment. It's never to be repeated. It's also televised. So basically, I'm saying here, it seems to me to be, and I know it is, I think, to you, the kind of center of the universe. And, you know, is that fairly true, do you think? I mean, I'm mumbling away here, trying to find a sensible question about football because it's 50% of your life. No, 65% of your life.
Well, I think that one of the interesting things about sport is that, you know, it matters because it's so important to people. I mean, it's a kind of, you know, it's kind of a circular thing. But, you know, for me, if football was a minority sport and Arsenal played in front of 25 people and a dog, I wouldn't be as interested. But for me, the drama is all that going on in front of this sea of faces and people who are sort of, you know, passionate about what they see in front of them. But I suppose we live in a world where there doesn't seem to be a centre anywhere, and you do feel temporarily on a Saturday afternoon that where you are, there are people beyond your immediate circle who are focusing on that. I know, you know, people up and down the country listening to radios and games like the last game of the season when Tottenham, of course, let Arsenal down and lost at Manchester United. But you do feel that you're somewhere that people want to be. And that feeling's, I think, more and more special now.
Yeah. Before you came along, I think you could, if you try to chat up a woman and you mentioned football, that would be the end of the date. But now, of course, you know, since FIFA has come along, you can actually, actually form relationships with women based on fixtures.
That's why I wrote it.
Yes. and I think if football is the centre of the universe, then music views the harmony of the spheres, in a sense. In High Fidelity, of course, you know, popular music, for want of a better term, again, structures Rob Fleming's life, but he also, I'm not quite sure about this, but sometimes he seems that he likes pop music because he's unhappy, and other times he seems to, feel that pop music makes him unhappy, but at the same time, it's his identity.
Mm. Well, that question that he sort of poses to himself in High Fidelity, which came first, the music or the misery, I have no answer to it, but I don't think it's sort of straightforward. I think that there are probably personality types who are drawn to like pop music, especially a kind of melancholic strain of music when they're sort of 13 or 14, and it probably does shape your expectations. One of the reasons I wrote High Fidelity is that I was talking to a guy, really nice guy, publisher, about music, and he suddenly said, you know, it does me no good, this job. I get in to my car in the morning and I put on a tape and I live at a very kind of heightened pitch on my way to work. Now I'm listening, I don't know, to Bob Dylan or to Mozart or something, and I'm kind of, you know, it makes you feel raw. And then I get to my desk and I open, I pick up a manuscript and I start reading about, you know, whatever, somebody dying of cancer or somebody smothering their children. And then I get back home and then I put the music back on. And he said, this is no way for somebody to live. you know, that this stuff, things like music, are supposed to really punctuate your life and kind of make it less mundane. And those who make things like music the centre of their lives, I think that it does create expectations and yearnings that can't possibly be fulfilled. I think that the same is probably true for writers to a certain extent. You spend your days thinking about stuff you shouldn't really think about.
Yeah. But, as teenagers, you go around dressed according to plan. You know, if you're a heavy metal fan, you're going to sort of wear black Sabbath T-shirts and long hair that hasn't been washed in a week. Or if you're, you dress in a kind of glam way or goth way or something. And it's all about, finding an identity, finding a peer group. Mm. But as we get older, how long can you be an Oasis fan? I'm not saying you are, but I'm just saying, you get you'll still be writing at 65 your nth novel. But where are you going to draw? I mean, how do you graduate, basically, in this business?
Yeah,
Music fan.
Well, I think that's interesting. We're going to be the first few generations that lived their whole lives through popular culture. Mm. And that wasn't something I think that was ever anticipated. I think I was always told by my father and that generation that I'd be listening to this stuff till I was 20, and then I'd walk straight off to the Royal Festival Hall. And it never happened, because it never had to happen, because there was always someone slightly older than me to whom it hadn't happened either. And now we've got, Bob Dylan and Mick Jagger and so on, who are nearly 60. And
John Peel.
John Peel, yes, that's right. And I think that the age thing has ceased to be of relevance. I think that you can judge when you shouldn't be listening to stuff. I mean, I don't listen to any dance music or sort of club music, because I don't go to clubs, and I think it's about time I felt alienated by something. And I'm 42, and it was I think if you do listen to Oasis, what is there to be alienated by? It's, bass, drums, guitars, verse, chorus, and it's the music you've been listening to all your life. But I think that you can judge when it's inappropriate and when it's unseemly.
Yeah. I'm going to open this out now to the audience. I can see a hand at the back there.
I was wondering if you'd like to comment on the self-observation that you're trying to be the regional people who have had hang out in kitchens and parties and have
Well, I think in the same piece, Will Self went on to say that he never hung out in parties, and he was out there in the middle of the dance floor grabbing anything that moved. And I know which side I'm on, basically. I mean, when I walk into a party and I see someone in the middle of the dance floor grabbing anything that moves, I don't want to go near them. And I think what's interesting is that if you're a writer, you're supposed to be, as well, some kind of observer. And I think it's probably easier to observe in the kitchen than somewhere else. So.
Yeah. How do you feel about writers who get paid footballer's salaries?
Or like me.
Can I tell you, this is all public knowledge anyway, but Nick just got £2 million advance for two books from Penguin recently. A couple of noughts, what the hell?
It's basically, for me, entirely dependent on whether you can justify it commercially or not. I mean, for good or ill, I'm in a situation where actually I'm not going to be, because of this deal, I won't be earning any more over the next few years than I've been earning for the last few years, when in fact the advances for these three books were very small, and all the money's come from royalties. The only way to have any real strong opinion is to say that society is structured wrong and there should be a maximum salary for everybody and so on and so forth, which I'm not unsympathetic to, but I don't feel, if I can justify a footballer's salary, I should earn a footballer's salary until such time as Mr. Blair and his radical government prevent me from doing so. Hi. Yeah.
Now,
have I read them? No.
Now that you've done it, do you ever feel disappointed at the
I mean, there are enough books that I want to read that I don't feel disappointed by. The one book I'm glad that I wrote and not read is Fever Pitch, partly because it was my first book, and if, having not written my first book, that had come through my letterbox or I'd seen it in a bookshop, I think I would have hung myself.
Well, you know, that
there's a, you know, somebody writing about their lifelong relationship with Arsenal and wanting to write, and it would have got to me, I think, that one.
Yes.
At the back.
How do you feel about people who come up to you and say about the pitch, this book is about me? Does it make you happy? Does it actually make you want to turn around and go, no, it's about me?
No, I mean, that was... it was deliberate. I don't mean that it was untruthful or self-conscious, but why I wanted to write Fever Pitch, and to a certain extent and a slightly lesser extent High Fidelity, was that the story that I was telling I recognised in an awful lot of people that I knew in my immediate circle, and it seemed to be a story that hadn't really been told about a certain generation and a certain class, I suppose, of Englishmen. And there was the editing process, the self-editing process that went on in Fever Pitch was that, you know, of course, if you're writing about your family and relationships and things, that you could go up some blind alleys, you know, and I could have kind of banged on about my dad or banged on about my mum in a way that I don't think people would have found very interesting. So to me, it was very good self-discipline to keep it to the story that I knew was true for an awful lot of people. So... to me it's great if people come up and say that. And I thought always, again, that it was supposed to be one of the purposes of literature, that one of the pleasures of books was that you could find yourself in the pages of books. And I think that's something that's been lost sight of in the last 40 or 50 years.
Russ, you had a
question. So following off from that, does it bother you when people say that you've got to be a bloke to read High Fidelity?
It doesn't bother me now because enough women have come up to me and said something different about it. I think that partly Fever Pitch and High Fidelity were written for women because they were partly conceived as an explanation as well. And if you're explaining, then you have to kind of presuppose that people don't know the stuff you're talking about. And, you know, for one reason or another, a lot of that happened to be women, especially with the first book. And I had a woman editor, woman agent, and I knew they were going to be the first readers of the book. What's happened that's interested me over the last couple of years, when women picked up High Fidelity, first of all, I think a lot of them had been told to read it as, you know, an insight into the male psyche. And then... over the last couple of years, quite a few women have said to me, I was told to read this because it would be about blokes and I would understand blokes better. And yet I identify with the central character. I identify with Rob. You know, I'm 35. I don't know what the fuck I want to do with my life and I keep messing up my relationships. I mean, that's kind of a transgender thing. So... I'd hate it if women didn't pick up the book because they felt that it only men would understand it, yes, but it hasn't been my experience, actually.
Well, a friend of mine actually gave it to his partner to read, and he sat at the table watching her read it, you know, his arm folded, you know, waiting for the reaction. And of course, it's a book about obsession as much as about anything else, and that, in that respect, is very universal. Any other questions?
The case for the beach, for example, where certain characters, the nationality has been changed from English life to American life. What kind of jurisdiction would you have in a situation whereby, say, a high fidelity, where they made something that was completely against what you thought the book was about? What kind of course of action would you be able to do?
Well,
give a sort of complicated answer to that, I suppose. First of all, High Fidelity is being made at the moment, and it's set in the States, so it has been transposed. There are two things about that. First of all, I sold it. And I think a lot of writers, they seem to kind of, you know, they're very good with words up until this point, where they seem to misunderstand what the word sell means. And they sell it, and then they sort of moan about it. And it's like, you know, somebody who sells a leather jacket, and then they say, oh, I don't want him wearing it, he's fat, I want it back, you know. And that seems to be the attitude of a lot of writers, that they want to take the money, and then afterwards they want to complain about it. It's not mine anymore, I sold it, and I wrote it as a book, and I was happy with the book, and anything that anyone else wants to do with it is fine by me. Having said that, what's been interesting for me, the process of High Fidelity, is that it fell into the hands of incredibly sympathetic people who loved the book, who understood the book, nothing to do with it being English. There are three American guys, including John Cusack, who recognised themselves in it in the same way that people here recognise themselves in it, and they've taken it and they've put it in their hometown as opposed to my hometown, which is Chicago. And it makes perfect emotional sense. I mean, for me, the most important thing is it's done by good people, I suppose. Once I've taken the money and I have any vague hope that it's done by good people. And the people involved are top-notch. And I recognise that they have to make changes that make sense to them in terms of, you know, changes to a character or changes to dialogue. They've been incredibly faithful to the story of the book, and to me, High Fidelity wasn't about being English. It was about being a certain person at a certain time. So I'm fine about it.
Nick, your books are very powerful. In fact, to turn the set thing on its head, which is a totally incredible thing. I will not allow certain mid-30s male friends of mine to read High Fidelity, especially if they're under achievers, because they're and Russell, contrary to what you said, I'm a female footballer, and he did actually the 10 football matches before I read Phoebe's pitch. But when I read Phoebe's pitch, it was so deep and meaningful to me that it quite depressed me. I've been on football for at least 10 days. So I just wondered, Nick, are you writing, therefore, to entertain? Or to almost.
Or to depress?
Not to depress.
I'm not sure about the catharsis. I think that if you do see that other people do what you do and think what you think, that there is a great relief in that, and there can be a catharsis. I mean, I want to entertain, but not in a disposable way, I suppose, is the simple answer. I wouldn't like people to read the last page and throw the book over their shoulder. At the back?
Are you pleased or horrified by the film version?
Well, I mean, that was a different process for me because I wrote the screenplay. So it was a pretty faithful adaptation of the version of the screenplay that I wrote. What I had to do to the book, if it was going to be a film, was to create a narrative and to simplify it. I knew that had to be done. But the film's very different from the book, and I think books are always, in the end, more complex because a faithful film adaptation of a book would probably last 12 hours. I mean, that's how long it takes to read the thing. And you've got to reduce that to 90 minutes. I loved the whole experience of being involved with the film of Fever Pitch, and I think we're very lucky, writers in England, that there's a kind of layer of finance missing. I mean, in a way, it's sad because the films are always underfunded and underbudgeted, and you have to stretch your resources to the limit. And if there's anything wrong for me with Fever Pitch, is that we were £1 million short. But you don't have men in suits
telling you that you have to change the end of this, or you have to put an American in here, or do all, any of those things, because the British film industry can't support those men in suits, and it can't order a reshoot of an ending because you've already used all your money up. And that's a very healthy situation for writers, I think, because you're given more of a chance here than in the States. So I think things are good for us at the moment on with the screen side of things.
It's kind of appropriate too, I think, that you know you draw from popular culture and then you send it back in a sense through the medium of the movie.
Yeah, and it's it is a very powerful medium, and I think there is a whole generation of writers who've probably grown up having watched more movies than they've read books.
Yeah.
And it's natural that they want to go back in there.
Yes. David, and you next.
What's your response to the results of 17 minutes,
Manchester
United 0?
Oui. That means there'll be something. As the Welsh guy scored for Bayern, yeah. well, it means there'll be something to watch afterwards,
yeah.
Anyway.
There's a fight going on there.
It's probably slightly less, and it's nothing to do with the makeup of the team, basically. I've never understood this, that Arsenal can buy a load of players from Stoke and Sunderland, and I'm supposed to feel more identification with them because they're British. I mean, France is nearer than Sunderland and to Arsenal. I mean, to me, they're either Arsenal players or they're not Arsenal players, and I think that the trick is to inculcate players into the spirit of a club, and I think that for me people like Petit and Vieira are clearly Arsenal players now. I mean, there's no lack of commitment from them, and that's all I'm looking for is a commitment to the club. Yeah, which is a justifiable concern, but it doesn't make me not identify with the players that they have. I mean, that's a kind of theoretical concern about what the future of football will be, but I don't feel that the Arsenal team I'm watching now is less of an Arsenal team because it's got French and Dutch players in it at all. What would put me off is if I felt that everyone was coming for a year and then clearing off, and that, you know, all of the big football clubs were kind of revolving door. Which I don't know, might happen at Chelsea, I think, that some of the players there don't seem, you know, they're coming towards the end of their careers and they know they're going to get a big payday. Whereas I think what Arsene Wenger's done is buy good young players, not expensive players, and mould them into a team.
We have time for one more. There is one more. Yes.
Well,
Nick, you did. This is something you never talked to me about. Sugar mice.
Sugar mice is it? Sugar mice is in Fever Pitch, and you can't get them. I would if I could, but. You know, it's what's ruined modern football is packaged sweets, I think. I do actually go. I don't know if it's a superstition or a routine. There's a very fine line, but there is a proper sweet shop round the corner from the ground on my way, and you have to get something in a paper bag, you know, quarters. You can't buy Mars bars or Maltesers or anything like that. It has to be disgusting 50 pence a quarter sweets.
Well, I think that's really all we have time for, but Nick is going to stay here for a while to sign copies of his books that you bought.
And, they'll be yours when
they'll be yours as well.
They're ours.
So anyway, thank you, Nick. Thank you.